Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. The title of this program is World Watchers. It's program number 783, December the 8th, 1986. I heard on the news today that Nancy Reagan had just been decorating her Christmas tree, and the theme of it is Mother Goose. It just synchronizes with an article I read yesterday regarding Stephen Sondheim's new play called Into the Woods. Many of you know he's one of my favorite composers. Into the Woods is having a tryout in San Diego. And what he does in the first act is take characters from Grimm's fairy tale, such as Jack and the Beanstalk, Cinderella, Little Red Riding Hood, Snow White, the Three Little Pigs, and so forth, and goes into the factor of people living out their fantasies, going into the woods where these people play and behave and where these characters go in search of their dreams. And in order to grow, according to the theme of this play, human beings every now and then have to take a adventure into the woods every now and then, not all of the time like the Reagans do, and certain aspects of our lives require that we have dreams that aren't tarnished and so forth. But the story of the play is that you shouldn't go out in the woods, you shouldn't venture there if you're not aware of what it can do to your mind. Those with weak minds shouldn't rely too much on fantasy, because every moment you have shouldn't be in the woods. And the second act is about people who get lost and disappointed because the realities of life aren't like their fantasies, their early fantasies. In fact, there's a song called Your Fault, which is described as various characters attempting to blame others for the consequences of their own actions. And that's exactly what Ronald Reagan does. He has always been held back by his infantile, his balloons and gumdrops. And now, you know, his Mother Goose Christmas tree. But he doesn't understand the real world or the reality, and when it happens, there's always somebody as a whipping boy. Interestingly enough, this U-Sidey that he called to do an article for him about the press being responsible for his problems, and he has this awful bile in his mouth. U-Sidey has been a long writer for Time magazine, and when I was invited to speak at the University of Oregon, Eugene, Oregon, I was supposed to be talking about the Kennedy assassination and telling the students about that. And before the lecture in the evening in the auditorium, we went to the airport to pick up another guest that was coming in. And the guest was U-Sidey. And the president of the university, or the people arranging my speaking there, said that I couldn't speak unless U-Sidey was there. That if I said there was a conspiracy to kill John Kennedy, then he would present the other side, that there wasn't a conspiracy. So instead of my talking for 40 minutes or so and taking questions, I could talk 20 minutes and he talked 20, and then he could counteract what I was saying. And was sent all the way from Washington, left the next day to be there. That's the man that Ronald Reagan calls in to lash out at the press when he has his problems. There's an article, not as dramatic as the Iran story or the Contragate, but terribly, I think it's very important, more important than a lot of the other things going on right now. It's titled Probation for Two Pals of Nancy Reagan's Maid. And it's from Richmond, Virginia. And it says two Paraguayans pleaded guilty to illegally exporting ammunition in a scheme that involved Nancy Reagan's maid. She was put on probation, and the other two were also put on probation. She received 2 years, and she's working in the White House. But what these two gentlemen said was that they were only carrying out orders from the Paraguayan military advisors when they were trying to smuggle 350,000 rounds of ammunition. And the maid, Anita Castello, was indicted for buying 10,000 rounds of illegal ammunition. Now, the history of civil rights, of human rights in Paraguay, is just horrendous. And Mr. Strassner has done a pretty good job of eliminating and sterilizing a huge proportion of the native Indian population. But their argument was the Nuremberg argument. I was only taking orders. And here we have a woman working in the White House, traveling on Air Force One with the president and his wife, who is supplying the military in Paraguay with ammunition coming directly from the White House. I'm sure that there are other places where they could get 350,000 rounds of ammunition from Argentina or a lot of other places, Chile, other sympathetic persons to Mr. Strassner. So it was directly to his military, and the story that it was for hunting or sports wasn't true at all. This is the International Year of Peace. The United Nations declared it. It's about over. And in concluding this year, they said that the cost of weapons throughout the world now is $1.7 million each minute for arms. So by the time this program is over, somebody has spent 60 plus the extra 7 times the 64, that many million weapons for arms. The United States is the largest buyer. The Soviet Union is the second. They go to countries where one out of three adults can't read, one in five live in poverty, and ammunition is made all over the world, shipped all over the world, and is painful for a large segment of the population who are excluded from a lot of the things that they should be enjoying if there weren't so many weapons. Sarah McClendon was on Michael Jackson's radio program. He's a radio spokesperson who has a talk show out in California that goes up and down the coast to different hours and different stations. She was on there last Friday, and in talking about the Contragate, she mentioned that all of Washington, and I don't know how many that is, but all of Washington are talking, the press corps people, about the Korean airline and the links of the Korean airline to the national security people that are now being exposed between the Iran and Contragate operations. We have to hear more about that because this came out on Friday, but the news Saturday, Sunday, and Monday didn't have anything about it at all. The closest they came to it was when Robert McFarlane was giving testimony before the House Intelligence Committee or Foreign Relations Committee just this morning, and one of the questions asked him was, what about weapons sent to Iran out of third countries besides ours? How many do you know about besides Israel? And he said, none to my knowledge. He didn't go into Saudi Arabia. They're just leaving all of these other links out. He said, not to my knowledge. And a member of Congress said, well, recent press reports said that the weapons to Iran involved third parties and shipments that came by way of the United States. And he said these date back several years ago to reports in 1983, keep in mind the 1983 day, when South Korea, one other country, was involved in investigations that the Customs Department of the United States had investigated in 1983 the possibility the weapons were reaching Iran through South Korea. And they cited the logs of used aircraft invoices in the summer of 82 and so forth and stated that the Korean Airlines is a registered arms exporter for our State Department, in our State Department. And then they purchased TOW missiles similar to those sent in Iran. And the shipments were not made to the Korean Airlines, but went on to some other undisclosed location. And the question was asked Robert McFarlane, were they sent by Korea to Iran? And he said, I haven't heard of those reports. Now, Colonel North, that works with Robert McFarlane, is very close to John Singlaub. Singlaub works with North. He's in and out of the National Security Council, and he's one of the head men for sending out money to Contras and to what Ronald Reagan calls the freedom fighters. And John Singlaub was on the board of Western Goals with the late Larry McDonald, and the opening up of the Western Goals Police Department files would have brought in a lot of persons from the military, like Edward Teller of Western Goals, or Admiral Moore, Thomas Moore, and a who's who of intelligence and right-wing fascists webbed together with John Reese and his wife in that $100,000 computer in Los Angeles. So I thought it was interesting that they briefly touched on the possibility that the Korean Airlines was delivering them, and the Korean airline is not a necessarily commercial airline, but it is a military. And the pilot, the night it went down, and the other pilots were part of the Korean CIA, which is identical to the CIA. As the story breaks, I'll do more links on the relationship of those people in the Iran and Contra operations linked to the Korean Airlines. We will see if it develops during the week. Because this is the anniversary of John Lennon's murder, I mentioned it last week. I just wanted to mention just a few items to update some more on it, because this is December the 8th. And I cited last week the articles, one November 14th, but all during the week, that a defendant in an arms to Iran trial, those 17 defendants, one of the defendants was a Mr. Eisenberg, and he was asking George Bush to come and be, they subpoenaed George Bush in his trial, And the attorney for Mr. Eisenberg is Jonathan Marks, the same attorney for Mark David Chapman. And they also want former National Security Advisor Robert McFarlane and Vice Admiral John Poindexter and Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North. They filed papers asking members of the National Security Council and so forth to be witnesses in this trial of Mr. Eisenberg, Gurriel Eisenberg. And we have the whole team that would work from the National Security with the assassination teams. And one another witness to their case, which I'll bring up to date, his murder next week, Mr. Hashemi, was murdered. He was a primary witness against these people and was killed in July of this past year. And there's another murder linked to them in Mr. Perry. And I'll update the murders to the Contra gate, the Contra Iranian gate, next week. So the attorney for this outfit and for Mr. Eisenberg, who is subpoenaing George Bush, is the same attorney as I mentioned before. Now, in 1980, when Ronald Reagan was just ready to come into office, there were articles about Richard Allen in the newspaper, and I had those several years ago, right after John Lennon was murdered. Just to refresh your memory, they had to do with Richard Allen's influence in the Nixon administration and how he represented a public relations agency, various people in Japan that were linked to Lockheed. And this one article, September 29, 1980, said, the story deals with Allen's activities when he was an assistant to Henry Kissinger, former President Nixon's National Security Advisor in 1969, deputy assistant to the President for International Economic Affairs. He was on the government's payroll when Allen used the White House for current and prospective business clients, and it tells about his consultations working with Robert Vesco and also with Nissan Motor Companies and Datsun Cars over in Japan. And one of the people he worked with in 1970 was Mr. Tamatsu, T-A-M-O-T-S-U, Tamatsu Takase, T-A-K-A-S-E, I don't know if I pronounced that right, who had influence and ties with Lockheed and Grumman. And, of course, Lockheed Organization was identified as being a cover for various persons who were linked to political assassinations with mob connections. And Richard Allen in the 70s was close to the same gentleman involved with Lockheed. And again, Lockheed was the cover for the murder of Robert Kennedy. Thane Caesar worked for Lockheed, and I've gone into the Aryan Nations. Richard Butler worked for Lockheed. And in the 70s, Richard Allen had close ties to these various persons from Datsun and so forth and Lockheed connections. Then the San Francisco Examiner and San Jose Mercury had a story about Richard Allen, and it said, on December the 8th, the day after his initial contact, again with Mr. Takase and his wife who came to Washington, the day after that contact, Allen wrote a two-paragraph memo to Reagan's scheduling director, Charles Tyson, later an Allen staffer at the National Security Council, and Tyson's name comes out now in regards to the scandal of the National Security Council. And he was meeting the very day that John Lennon was murdered, and as I cited last week, Michael Ledeen and Francesco Pazienza were meeting with Alexander Haig the day after John Lennon was murdered, and Haig and Ledeen and Kissinger and Allen, having worked under Henry Kissinger, were involved with people who have associations to past assassination teams, both the day Lennon was murdered and the day after. And these articles that I had a long time ago on World Watchers go back to Allen and his connections to these people and their contacts the very day, the evening of December 8th is when Lennon was murdered. The FBI had reports on Jen Lennon. I have one here, June the 5th, 1972. John Winston Lennon, revolutionary activities. This is why the FBI had reports on him. And it said the New York Airtel indicated information was received from Vincent Ciano, chief trial attorney from INS in New York, to the effect that he received information that the subject, John Lennon and his wife, Yoko Ono, are planning a large rock concert in Miami during the conventions, and that the rock concert would be held in front of the convention hall. And those were the reasons for following him and not having John Lennon have a rock concert at the time of the Nixon administration. Another article came, an FBI memo from the director, acting director of the FBI, August 30th, 1972, refers to the fact that John Lennon, for the past several months, there's been information received to indicate that the subject is active in the New Left. And then there's a large hunk of that blocked out, and they were talking about the subject being deported from the United States. I started writing my Why Was Martha Mitchell Kidnapped article in June of 72, and then Paul Krasner was with Yoko and John Lennon around July, and that's when they provided the money for him to get the article out, and they were in contact with us in August of 72 rather. So in this time period, there's a large hunk blocked out, but they were active in the New Left, and that was, of course, John Lennon's activities and friendship with Paul Krasner and their participation. We'll never know what they blocked out, but those papers of Lennon's are completely wiped out, and we won't know if they were interested in their having anything to do with The Realist or the article that came out about Richard Nixon and Watergate. Jack Anderson had an article in 1977. He said, in a case with Watergate overtones, John Lennon is being hustled out of the United States on a 6-year-old hashish charge. The singer-composer's major problem didn't appear to be his 1968 guilty plea in England for possessing some hash. His offense seems to be his outspoken opposition to the Vietnam War and false rumors that he was going to have a demonstration in 1972. Immigration and Naturalization began their papers to deport him after Senator Strom Thurmond began getting troublesome with the INS. In early 72, Thurmond wrote a note about Lennon's activities to his friend, Attorney General John Mitchell, and that's when they decided that they better deport Lennon because they didn't want him visible at the time of the Republican convention in 1972. Then on Good Morning America, September 24th, 1981, Jack Anderson wrote, my Justice Department says that the name of Strom Thurmond, the crusty South Carolina senator, has turned up in the Turple Wilson case. And, of course, Turple Wilson show up now in the case of Mr. Hakim and Theodore Shackley and Mr. Secord and so forth in 1986. But this was going back to 1981. Investigators are checking into a possible connection between the former Thurmond aide and two renegade agents. Now I should add, the senator himself probably didn't have any idea that his name was being used, but here is the story. A key government witness has charged the Turple in 1976 with someone named the Preacher. Turple said the Preacher was a chief aide to Senator Thurmond. The alleged purpose of the meeting was to figure out a way to get 850 transport planes delivered to Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi. Turple had been offered $1 million commission for each plane that reached Libya. The government witness told my office that the Preacher was supposed to get them released through Strom Thurmond's office. The witness said Turple offered $500,000 for each plane that Thurmond could get released, $250,000 for the senator, $250,000 for the Preacher. I've tracked down the Preacher. His name is R.C. Whitner. His nickname is the Preacher. It comes from his middle name, which is Church. He was never a chief aide to Strom Thurmond. He merely worked for the senator as a fundraiser for Strom Thurmond. Whitner said he didn't know Turple, but admitted knowing Edwin Wilson. He also admitted that he had been in their office, denied any part in the plot. Spokesman for Thurmond said the senator never heard of the plot. There's no way to get the planes released. Now, I don't know what part that Strom Thurmond would have in helping get planes to Muammar Gaddafi. But if you've been hearing the news lately, and I'll update more on it, Jesse Helms and Strom Thurmond were instrumental in trying to have a military coup in Portugal and in the Azores, and were active politically there. And one of the purposes of getting weapons to Gaddafi would be what happened a few years later, then after he's armed, to come in and attack him as a terrorist having the weapons, and then get a strategic military base on the Mediterranean. There have been a lot of articles about Iran and Contra money and where it is going, where it isn't going, and how it doesn't show up. There was an article in San Francisco Examiner this past week, how U.S. auditors were kept in the dark, and it has a picture of Assistant Secretary of State Elliot Abrams, who refused to allow the general accounting auditors to go to Central America, Mr. Elliot Abrams, and his name is very important. There's a story today in the New York Times, Reagan aides doubt Contras can survive. They may be doomed, and they cite Mr. Elliot Abrams. He says that to get renewed support for the United States, the Contras will have to get it for themselves with their performance on the ground, both military and political. Now, one of the drastic changes in this is that there is drug money involved with the Contras, and all of a sudden, Mr. Elliot Abrams must be dropping it like a hot potato or hoping to separate himself from the Contras at this point until the trial of the Christic Institute and the allegations that there's drug money linked to the Swiss bank accounts and so forth is either exposed or sufficiently buried. Another story this week, Swiss bank freezes account involved in Iran arms sales. And that may be a bank very easily traced to drug traffic and drug money. Another one, Afghan and Angolans may have gotten funds. And now we get closer, and I'm working up to a story on Elliot Abrams and money that is supposed to go to Afghan freedom fighters, which goes into drugs in South America. Another story, U.S. recalled records called sloppy on non-lethal aid to Contras. They didn't keep account of how their money was spent. Another one, the CIA mixing Afghan Contra funds is dumb. This is the Washington Post. Another one, pilot flying arms to Contras had account at a Swiss bank. And these very people using Southern Air Transport and Air America are known for the narcotics money and profits they brought in from Southeast Asia and the dope traffic. And the Swiss bank accounts have been identified with Wallace Sawyer, one of the pilots of the CIA airline that went down, and his bank account in Switzerland was identified. So they're being linked to the Swiss banks, and the Swiss banks are tied up to Angola and Afghanistan. And another story in the New York Times this past week, agency says it can't verify the use of humanitarian aid to Contras. These are Washington Post and New York Times stories, Wall Street Journal, and so forth. And then along with those was an article which got a lot of attention this past weekend in the L.A. Times. I hope it went over the wire services in the East. George Shultz persuaded Sultan to donate money to the Contras. And this is about George Shultz going to Brunei to get several million dollars to give the Nicaraguan rebels last summer. And the money went to a Swiss bank account conducted by Lieutenant Colonel North of the National Security Council. The State Department refused to confirm or deny that Shultz solicited the contribution. It would not have been illegal for him to do it so long as the money was not intended for military aid, but they haven't identified where the money went, and certainly they can't say it was humanitarian because they won't even tell where it went, so it's a little bit suspicious. This article goes on to say the Assistant Secretary of State in charge of Latin America, Elliot Abrams, hit upon the idea of asking for help from Brunei. So it was Elliot Abrams, who won't let the General Accounting Office get into the money down with the Contras, who asked for the help. Brunei is a tiny nation on the Southeast Asian island of Borneo, whose oil and gas revenue gave it one of the highest per capita incomes in the world. The Sultan, strongly anti-communist ruler, has sought a closer relationship with the United States, agreed to help Nicaragua rebel cause. At Abrams' suggestion, George Shultz went down there and lobbied the mini-state's dynastic ruler, Sultan Bolkiah. The Secretary of State even dropped in for a three-hour visit at the Sultan's 1,788-room castle. The Swiss bank account was not set up originally by the CIA, which was prohibited from handing aid to the Contras. Well, interestingly enough, the pilot who worked for the CIA in a CIA airplane had a Swiss bank account, but this wasn't set up by the CIA. That's a figure of speech. It could be set up by the DIA or the NSC. It doesn't have to be just CIA. Instead, they said it was apparently set up by North, who's in the National Security Council, or one of his associates of that network that at the time was transferring profits from Iran into the accounts of the Contras. The CIA acknowledged getting $12 million, and they can't account for maybe $20 to $30 million, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. If the Brunei money was used for military purposes, it would appear to be at odds with the congressional restrictions. And the article goes on, as I say, to implicate the head of the Central American South American Affairs, Elliot Abrams, and his suggestion that George Shultz go to Brunei. Well, in the summer of 1986, I saved articles about George Shultz in the small island of Brunei. One of them is from the L.A. Times. Rich small Brunei gives Shultz a palatial stopover. And as luck would have it, I had a record of his visit. And this is the one where Elliot Abrams and Lieutenant Colonel North and so forth were pumping him for $1 or $2 million. Now, if those millions were put into a fund for the Contras, they wouldn't be so dirt poor. And the point of my bringing this up is that we're tapping into drug money, and this is why Ronald Reagan wants to hurry and get the case closed before January comes around and another Congress comes in. The LA Times article says that the Sultan Bolkiah is an absolute ruler of this Delaware-sized nation. It's made rich by oil and gas deposits. They entertained George Shultz in the palace, 1,788-room palace with inlaid marble, Philippine mahogany, gold glass mosaics. The United States, for its part, is all ready to do business with an anti-communist country, one that has no need for foreign aid, and he's going there begging money for the Contras. The relationship started less than 3 years ago when the United States established diplomatic relations with a newly independent sultanate. The U.S. Embassy staff consists of 6 Americans, and including the ambassador to Brunei. The officials said Brunei is a small place with small problems. Like the rich everywhere, it's concerned that someone might want to take its wealth away. The Sultan, who will be 40 years old next month, lives in the world's largest palace, recently opened by the Hyatt Regency and Marriott hotel chains, as big as either one of those hotels. It would be produced by them if they had unlimited money to spend. In contrast to his big palace, 25,000 people, more than 10,000, live in wooden shacks built on stilts on the Brunei River. They could be reached by boat. Islam is the state's religion, and there's manifestations of Islam fundamentalism there. But most of the people are kept down. They're pretty repressed and have no voting rights or any selections. Their ruler decides what is good for them, and he maintains the profits of all the oil and gas. The Sultan spent between $250 million and $500 million to build his palace. Most estimates say around the $400 million range. The Bechtel Corporation, which is Caspar Weinberger, our Secretary of Defense, and George Shultz, the Secretary of State, the Bechtel Corporation of San Francisco, which Shultz once headed, participated in the construction of the palace, which features rooms big enough to hold a football field, an outgoing dining area that seats 4,500 people at a time. So when Mr. Abrams suggests that George Shultz go down to Brunei, it must have been the other way around, because they were building this huge palace for him and have direct interest in that particular country. Now, a while back, I mentioned an article on Sikh terrorism and narcotics traffic and didn't get a chance to finish it, and said I would. This came out of New Solidarity, March 21st, 1986. It's called Sikh Terrorists and Dope Incorporated. And the gist of this article is that those persons behind the murder of Indira Gandhi in November 1985 have a London-based office, which I mentioned before, that Margaret Thatcher doesn't care to shake around. The Jagjit Chauhan, Chauhan, is the head of the Khalistan movement to separate the Sikhs, separate in the Punjab in India, away from India. And he's the fellow who brags about offering money to kill Mrs. Gandhi. These Sikhs were involved in a large drug arrest in New York City in 1985, in Newark, New Jersey, rather, where there were 22 pounds of heroin confiscated. There was $40 million worth of drugs in this one arrest in New Jersey. And I think I've mentioned before on World Watchers how the Sikh organization was invited down to Ecuador, in Quito, Ecuador. And this is their known main residence now, London and Ecuador. And this is also, in Ecuador, the location for the Israeli Mossad and General Raham Zevi, who became an official advisor to the Ecuadorian government, set up the Israeli organized mafia drug connections that are the pipeline that formerly ruled Bolivia under the cocaine kings when they were forced to leave, when Klaus Barbie went to France for his little internment in the jail, and the cocaine colonels who visited the GOP convention in Dallas, Texas, the last one, anxious to return back to Bolivia, and the cocaine colonels have moved to Ecuador and are working with the Sikhs, and also Richard Allen was photographed with them in Dallas, Texas at the time of the convention, and it does business with these particular cocaine colonels. The Khalistan headquarters have moved to Ecuador, and the gist of this article tells not only about Mr. Chauhan and the Sikh terrorist narcotics traffic, but it says that among the countries that they negotiate with for drugs are Morocco and Brunei. The Brunei is one of the drug centers that deals and works with and is influenced by the Sikhs in London, and also obviously with our Mr. Elliot Abrams, who can't account for where money is, and George Shultz, the Secretary of State, who's very thick with the tremendous contracts of $3 or $4 million that we know of on the little section of an island of Borneo called Brunei. I'll take a 1 minute break now because this first half hour is over, and do a little bit more on some of the drug connections and other stories related to the Iran gate, the Contra gate, and call it what you want. It's going to be on for a long while.